Welcome to Harlow on Healthcare. I'm David Harlow, and I invite you to join me by my virtual hearth as I sit down with healthcare leaders to discuss building the future of healthcare. Today, my guest is Cindy Friend, Vice President of Clinical Population Health Solutions and Transformation at Caradigm, a GE healthcare company. You can find Cindy on LinkedIn, and you can find Caradigm on Twitter at Caradigm, C-A-R-A-D-I-G-M. Cindy is a registered nurse with more than 20 years of combined experience in healthcare administration, clinical delivery, and health information technology, both in the public and private sectors. Her clinical, technical, and managerial experience in provider, payer, and government organizations gives her a broad understanding of the challenges faced by the healthcare industry. Welcome, Cindy, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, David.
Well, we certainly need some solutions and some transformation in the realm of population health. I think as a starter, can you define for us, what do you mean when you say population health?
You know, I've been in healthcare for years when it was patient-centered care, and then we individually started to grow into the family-centered care model, and then the extended family and caregivers, and then the concept of population health started to emerge, I think, when I was getting involved in the late 90s, early 2000s under disease management, and really looking at how do we start to identify patients that are the most high need, high cost patients, and provide them with better care, support, and services. So when I think of population health, if you will, I think of it as really the stratification of patients across the population. You're going to have patients with heart failure, beginning stages, end stages, same thing with diabetes, kidney failure, and so forth. And these patients will tend to be peppered throughout the patient paradigm. But what you have to remember is they're going to have patients that have more acute needs. So when I think about population health, I think about it as that stratification and identifying those patients. You're going to have patients with multiple chronic conditions. You might have patients in that high-risk stratification, if you will, that have needs for hospice or end-of-life issues. There might also be some traumatic issues that you just can't do anything about, but certainly helping those patients to receive the services they need. You have those patients that are really defined as that what they call the rising risk. So that starts to allow us the opportunity to identify patients that have multiple chronic conditions. They may not have those labs or diagnostics that have some indicators, but they certainly have the care needs, compliance issues that many other patients have as well. And then as you look further down that patient, you just see different healthcare needs and levels of care needs. So when I think of population health, I think of looking at patients in those, not just from a conditional perspective, because usually it's not just a condition. They have multiple chronic conditions or psychosocial issues, socioeconomic issues. So I think I look at it as looking at your whole entire community or population that you serve, whether it be in a local health system or whether it's more national at a provider level or a payer level, you know, in looking at the patients that they managed in that perspective.
Right. So part of my background is in public health and government, and I have that sort of perspective as well from that experience, looking at really health of populations. And as soon as you said stratification, that sort of rings a bell for me in a big way, and identifying who needs what and who needs that now versus later. I guess I'm be interested in hearing from you about sort of a handful of some of the top issues that you see as crying out for solutions. You've touched on maybe a couple of them in your statements already, but are there areas that really are calling out for solutions or maybe are ripe for transformation? Particular disease states, types of disease, or other ways of categorizing patients or clinical needs?
You know, that's a great question. It's interesting, I think, as we all reflect back on that, you know, that report that came out from IOM and crossing the healthcare chasm. And, you know, it was, you know, really brought to light about the volume of patients. You know, we have that 80-20 rule, 80% of costs go to these 20% of patients that have these certain chronic conditions, namely heart failure and diabetes. But I think as we've gotten our arms a little bit more around data aggregation, I think that has enabled us to have a broader view of what the patient's needs are. And I've just found it interesting. I've actually been on the the state side and the policy mm-hmm. side of things as well, and you know, having to look at large data sets in that manner, and even on the payer side at my time with Blue Cross and Blue Shield. But I found it very interesting. Even in my consulting and working with clients around the country, that it varies from region to region, right? So what you may see as conditions that may be prevalent, and I'll use, you know, say Kentucky or Mississippi as an example, than you would find in, say, Connecticut or Colorado. So for here an example in the Mid-Atlantic for a large commercial population. It was interesting to find, of course, we didn't have as chronic conditions with and cost associated with heart failure and diabetes weren't our leading conditions. Osteoarthritis we found was our most costly condition. So to the point that, you know, what are some of those opportunities you can find? I think it's really getting your insight into the data, understanding it, and understanding the population and needs. I think another issue, and I think this is something that we've been grappling with for some time, and that's really the integration of behavioral health. I think, and that's one of the things we've been working on, is the integration and automation of that type of data collection and using that data in words, in a sense that you are able to then use that in some predictive fashion. You know, if you understand a patient has, you know, financial issues or some other, you know, other issues within that realm, you're able to then act upon it, maybe try to do some preventions or interventions.
You're talking about highlighting needs or information about patients in the behavioral health realm and integrating that into the management of the patient within a population. Are you suggesting also that the behavioral health services delivery be integrated, or would you still see that as appropriately carved out up front? You know, not that it needs to be carved out of the total patient management, but it may be delivered through a different system.
Yeah, I think, you know, the acceptance of, you know, kind of the behavioral health issues that we're faced with these days, I think it kind of reminds me, you know, back in the mid-90s when, you know, it's kind of that push for advanced directives, right? We tend to have these focuses, you know, folks have to get comfortable with having those conversations, and mental health certainly is one that has taken some time. I don't necessarily think it's something that we can somehow or another figure out how to get it fully integrated to primary care. I certainly don't think it's something that always needs to be transitioned out from a clinical perspective. I think it's really it's impressive that a lot of clinical clinicians have started to integrate the use of certain assessment tools depending on what the issue may be for a certain patient. But for depression, you have your PHQ-2 or PHQ-9 that can mm-hmm. lead you to certain indicators that would identify whether a patient would benefit from having further evaluation. But I think from where we stand with Caradigm and, you know, Population Health IT Solutions, taking that information, how do you kind of capture that information from a care management side through the system, and then use that information as well from an analytic perspective?
So what I hear you saying is that decisions about particular areas of focus need to be made locally, but you are able to provide a tool set that allows a local provider organization, whether it's an ACO or otherwise, to identify needs and manage those care needs in a local population.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I mean, understanding somebody's, you know, literature, health literacy, you know, their ability to, you know, comprehend that information. Do they even have the ability to read documents? Do they have any physical environment, social support needs? If they're lacking those types of things, you know, we can throw as many prescriptions at them that we want and as many care plans at them as we want. But if they don't have some basic elements of their, you know, basic needs being met or lackings there. I mean, those elements you can tend to identify within certain geographical areas, identifying potentially getting resources, potentially identifying some funding mechanisms, perhaps at some point. So, yeah.
Right. So being able to screen and being able to use the healthcare system as perhaps a point of entry into a broader social safety net or other kinds of services.
Yeah, I agree.
So I tipped my hand. I used the acronym ACO, and I wanted to ask you about a bunch of recent reports on ACOs that have been issued by both government agencies and industry associations over the past couple of months. Personally, earlier on, I was very much a big booster of ACOs and was enthralled by the idea behind their promotion and creation. And at this stage of the game, I would count myself among the disillusioned. I feel like the whole idea has been overhyped. But I'd like to hear your perspective on these reports and sort of also whether the reports that have been issued recently are relevant today and going forward, given the fact that there may be some redesign of ACOs going forward. Or when we say ACO, we may mean something different in the future versus what happened during the time period that these reports cover.
So, yeah, the reports that you're speaking of, there was the ACO survey results that came out from the National Association of Accountable Care Organizations. And then the hospital review, Becker's Hospital Review, had released some kind of high-level results regarding the savings and quality results for the pioneers and simply just some savings or losses from those that are participating, the ACO organizations in the next gen. To your point, it's interesting. I think, you know, as we all kind of heard about this concept of accountable care kind of, I think, started emerging on the scene back in like 1996. I think it was mentioned in a meeting. I can't remember the gentleman to give him credit for that. But I think as the programs that had come forth from the federal government, I think as people got more acclimated to them and got a better insight and their hands wrapped around and a better understanding of the requirements, they started to realize that the shared savings, while it comes across as the shared saving, it's really you can share in 50 cents on every dollar you save us, right? So I think in that aspect, and I think while that was great, okay, great, we're doing the right thing, we're cutting out waste, we're better coordinating patient care. And then what we have to think about is eventually that that benchmarking still remains, those calculations and formulas that establish those benchmarkings are still the same, but yet we've squeezed out enough. Where does it plateau? And I think that's where folks are really starting to push more for, a little bit more better look at how the risk arrangements are made. And certainly, you know, as you enter into risk arrangements, you want to make sure that you're not having more of a downside and that you're certainly on the upside winning side of that because of the penalties that can kind of associate with that.
If you're just tuning in, this is Harlow on Healthcare, coming to you on Healthcare Now Radio. I'm David Harlow, and my guest today is Cindy Friend. So we're talking about ACOs and the current state of the ACO, if you will. You mentioned a couple of reports that have come out recently. I've also been thinking about some of the government reports as well. There was sort of a status report, if you will, from CMS and a report from the OIG on performance of ACOs. And overall, I mean, all of these reports, I think, have shown that there is perhaps some progress being made in terms of managing care and managing cost. But the opportunity for savings is really incremental. And next year, you're judged based on something different. Because if you've saved money this year, you move the needle, you move the goalposts, if you will, for next year. And the savings overall seem to me to be relatively small given the huge budget of the Medicare program.
We're really at the beginnings of all this. I mean, to have the expectations that we come in and take a chunk out of the monster that is known as CMS, that's pretty audacious effort or goal there. I do think that, you know, it's a starting point, right? You know, we've had some people that have done very well, to their own surprise, if you will. And I also think that, you know, some of the results and some of these pioneers and next gens, they're some of our more advanced folks that we look to. And I think it kind of also demonstrates that even those that have maybe the means or the resources and so forth, you know, there's still things that you need to keep your eye on the ball. And one of the points that I really gleaned from, you know, kind of looking at one information source and then the information from CMS and then the information from NACOS was that, you know, those that were even doing well from just their quality perspectives, you know, you have to have an eye and a handle on how your financial performance is. Because you can have great, you know, clinical quality indicators and all your quality measures are looking great. All your outcomes are well. You're in the 90th percentile, but you lost $15 million. You have to own some of that. I think that's where, you know, the integration of not just looking at, you know, quality indicators or your clinical information, it's how do you then start to get a very good system in place that gives you a 360 view, not just of your clinical or your business and your operational, but also your financial and your utilization and where are those patients going? You're accountable for their care, but where are they going? How's your network performing and so forth?
Right. The question is, how do we continue improving? Are there particular areas where you see great successes, particular areas where you see need for improvement? I don't mean geographic areas. I mean areas of endeavor by particular ACOs, particular care delivery organizations. What do you think is out there that's going well? What do you think is out there that needs much more work?
Yeah, I think those that I see that are succeeding really have a great care management. They've looked at it not just from their individual care settings, that being acute or outpatient, you know, long-term care, et cetera. They look at it across the system, how they integrate, what types of information they must share, who's involved, what are the outcomes, and starting to kind of set things up that in that sense. The other thing I think is, you know, having a strong provider engagement. Those that have a very good governance provider engagement, and a lot of transparency on the information and how those doctors are being kind of measured or scored themselves, I think those have a lot of success. I think that most importantly, those that have the right types of technology systems, you know, we've done this, you know, with a couple hundred thousand patients, and you can kind of put them in an Excel spreadsheet and, you know, mix and sort them and divide them up amongst the nurses, and everybody gets a list and everybody starts calling the patients and we all take little copious little notes. It doesn't work like that. Not when you're managing, you know, a couple hundred thousand patients and a couple million in some instances. So I think those that really are succeeding are those that actually have, as I said a moment ago, the complete insight through both not only their any clinical data from their EHR, their billing, payment data, financial data, their claims, labs, et cetera, even pharmacy. There's a lot of opportunity as it relates to pharmacy and generic use, et cetera. So I think that's where I've seen a lot of organizations that are highly successful. I think areas where we see improvement is a better integration with our post-acute. We kind of see that really showing its head through our bundle payments initiatives that have been underway for several years. And I think that's improving for those that are participating, and they see the value in, since they have that accountability for patients post 90 days, their discharge. So I think that's where we're seeing areas of improvements, better integration between not just the hospital and the physician, but beyond those, the other care providers within the community.
Sure, really providing a continuum of care, as they say. That's very important. Yeah, to your point about sort of the record keeping and the need for an integrated system, I've been involved in ginning up one of the early gain sharing demonstrations before the ACA, and the whole thing was run off of a system of Excel spreadsheets because the enterprise financial system of the health system couldn't accommodate the adjustments and the everything else that needed to happen for the gain sharing demo. It was a little ridiculous. Not a way to do business in the long term.
Most certainly not.
Do you see any particular type of ACO as being more successful than another, whether it's physician led or whether it's a particular flavor of ACO? We're talking about Pioneer, we're talking about Next Generation, we're talking about there are a variety of different targets, measures, a variety of different opportunities and options that are changing over time. Are there any sort of newly available modes of being an ACO that you see as better than others?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, as we all started all of this, we always thought, oh, the hospital-led ACOs are going to kind of take the forefront. You know, they have the capital, they have the backing. They tend to kind of be the center of the community, if you will, from the healthcare perspective because of their size. From what I've actually seen and witnessed over the years, though, is those that are physician-led, I've seen be very successful. I mean, if you think about it, in some of the earlier days as I was working with clients, the real hesitance and resistance from them in joining an ACO is the fact that they realize the whole point of the success of an ACO is if keeping a patient out of the hospital, right? Reducing your ED utilization, reducing your unnecessary or preventable hospitalization. So, you know, the physician-led, while they didn't have a lot of the funding, some of the programs, you know, parts of the MSSP and so forth that gave some upfront resources, financial support to those types of ACOs did help them, and they are being very successful. Some of the other things that we're seeing come forth is these organizations that are almost becoming like conveners. So they come, you know, kind of go out. You have Aledade, right? So Farzad, who's the former, right, you know, head of the ONC, who is leading up Aledade now, and they kind of go out and they find these areas of pockets where there's not a lot of movement. They work with them. They provide them with the tools, the support, the resources, and help them come together to form these ACOs. So those are some additional ones. I think, you know, we've seen probably the ones of the hospital health systems. They're still emerging. You can imagine we have thousands of hospitals. We have, you know, hundreds of ACOs. So there's still some growth that's occurring out there. I think even as we see now, you know, your pioneers and your next gens, those are really the big ones. And then you have obviously the MSSP ACOs. Some of them have just now starting. Some have been, you know, in there for a little while, transitioning perhaps to their, you know, one plus. Some that are already into risk. So I see we're seeing a lot of growth in that manner. It'd be interesting to see. I've actually started to see in a client I worked with in Northern Kentucky, went in to help them with some, you know, going into their MSSP ACO at the time, as well as kind of considering some full risk capitated arrangements with some Medicare Advantage payers. But one of the things that we had recommended to them at the time was, hey, you know, potentially consider, because of your market share, your market gain, you're going to want to think about, you know, partnering with another ACO up in Cincinnati and to manage patients and offer, you know, a more robust system of services.
Right, right. Well, it'll be interesting to see how this proceeds in the future. So here I'm going to wrap up and ask you my last question, which is, if you were to wake up tomorrow and find yourself 5 years in the future, what is one thing in healthcare that you would either hope or expect to find has changed drastically?
My passion in healthcare has brought me into the health IT realm of things. So if I woke up in 5 years, what I would love to see is literally not another paper record in the system. I think everything, you know, electronically, appropriate protections, of course, and hotspots set up, and, you know, disaster recovery parameters in place. But ultimately, I think, you know, I've always envisioned, even when I was a nurse manager at the emergency department at a hospital outside of Washington, D.C., I always thought, you know, how great would this, could I make my ER look if it didn't have all these papers laying around? And I actually envisioned, like, all of us seamlessly, everything's clean and sparkly, and there's not a drop of post-it note around. My 5-year wish.
Okay, we can dream. We can dream. Well, thank you, Cindy. I appreciate your taking the time to speak with us today.
Okay, thank you, David. It's been my pleasure.
You have been listening to Harlow on Healthcare. Join us at healthcarenowradio.com. Let's continue the conversation on building the future of healthcare together at #HarlowOnHC on Twitter. I'm David Harlow, keeping the fire going and holding a seat open for you. Until next time.